The headlines: Iran says there are serious indications of Israel's role in the November terror attack on its top nuclear scientists and that it reserves the right to respond to it. Democrats edge closer to control the U.S. Senate with 98% of votes counted in key runoff elections in the state of Georgia. And also in our headlines, China says Hong Kong's move to arrest dozens of people over an unofficial opposition vote was necessary to stop external forces trying to undermine Beijing's stability. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Top story for this half hour: Iran's defense minister says there are serious indications of Israel's role in the November assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Amir Hatemi said Israeli intelligence services have a history of direct involvement in similar assassinations in Iran. He made the comments in separate messages to counterparts in 60 countries. The Iranian defense minister called Fakhrizadeh's assassination an inhumane act. He said Iran has the right to hold the perpetrators accountable. Hatemi argued that inaction would lead to the repeat of such incidents and insecurity. He also said the global fight against terrorism requires nations to refrain from double standards. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was killed in a terrorist attack near Tehran. The commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has vowed harsh revenge for the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
Our duty is clear. First is to take revenge from the murderers that committed this heinous crime. The revenge began at the very first moment that they assassinated top resistance commanders, and it will reach its end point. But this revenge has several steps. The enemy has been slapped twice and will be slapped two more times in the future. The first was the huge funeral procession that was held for General Soleimani and his comrades. The second was an attack on the U.S. base in Iraq that broke the grandeur of America. The third slap will be when the U.S. hegemony will be defeated. And the last one will be the U.S. withdrawal from the region.
Brigadier General Ghani was speaking at a ceremony marking the first anniversary of Soleimani's assassination. The ceremony took place in Soleimani's hometown, Kerman, in southern Iran. Ghani said U.S. forces will be crushed first and then they will be expelled from the West Asia region. He said the perpetrators of the crime will not be safe even in their own homes. The Iranian commander said the path of General Soleimani will continue. Soleimani was killed in a U.S. drone attack in Iraq last January. A ceremony is underway in Syria to mark the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes. Muhammad Ali says Syrians are paying tribute to Soleimani for his anti-terror efforts and his role in restoring stability to their country.
It's not the first event. There were so many previous events. What Syrians want to say in such events is that they want to express their appreciation and respect for all the efforts that General Soleimani did in Syria in order to defeat Daesh and help them restore stability to so many areas across the country. General Soleimani, of course, was heading all of the Iranian military advisors who were in Syria at the request of the Syrian government, assisting the Syrian army and the Syrian National Defense Forces to defeat terrorism and terrorists in general. And now, General Soleimani personally led so many battles against terrorists, for example, Al-Bukamal in 2017. He managed to lead all of the Syrian troops over there, the Syrian National Defense Forces, the Syrian army, the Lebanese Resistance Forces movement, Hezbollah, of course, who were fighting all alongside the Syrian side to get rid of Daesh. General Soleimani also helped in restoring security and stability to areas south of Aleppo, areas around Damascus. So the security that the Syrians are living in so many parts across the country, especially in the east, like Deir ez-Zor, also in the north near Aleppo, thanks to General Soleimani, the security and stability there was restored. General Soleimani helped Syria for long years against terrorism, not just Daesh, all kinds of terrorism that wanted to, undermine stability and security in Syria.
Iran's army has held the final phase of its maneuvers that used hundreds of indigenous UAVs. The military exercises are aimed at organizing and enhancing the preparedness of Iran's army in drone combat, as Yusuf Jalali reports.
all divisions of Iran's army are engaged in a full-scale war with a simulated enemy. This is the second and final day of the Iranian army drills held in central Iran. There's no direct confrontation, as the Iranian military carries out all its attacks remotely, using these pilotless aircraft. On the last phase of the drill, the army used its surveillance drones to track suspicious activities along its borders, while deploying its combat drones to the conflict area, where they destroyed their targets.
The main focus of attention in this drill was to attack distant hostile targets. As part of the exercise, we flew UAVs from our southern borders where they must target mobile objects in our country's central areas. All of our goals were met in this maneuver.
Iran stepped into the realm of UAVs in 2011 after it captured U.S. spy drone RQ-170 on its northeastern borders. It later produced copies of the captured UAV in different sizes, the last of which has an edge over its American peer. It has fighting features as well. But that was not where it ends. Iran's ambitions in the unmanned aircraft got the country to a level where it produces a variety of operational drones. One of the latest is this beast called Mohajer 6, which is a combat drone equipped with two seeker bombs that can lock onto their low-altitude air targets.
Today, Iran is the only regional power in terms of the drone technology. The UAVs that you saw today are made based on cutting-edge technology. Our UAVs are capable of conducting a variety of missions in different ranges and altitudes.
The drill comes as Iran and the U.S. have been engaged in a war of words, raising concerns about a potential conflict. Iran's military officials wrapped the U.S. for, quote, its military adventurism in the Persian Gulf, while pressing that they're prepared for any scenario.
Unfortunately, the U.S. military has recently carried out some provocative movements in the region. It has deployed its long-range aircraft to the region in what it calls a show of power. American officials have also made some accusations against the Islamic Republic. Now, this drill shows the readiness of our armed forces to defend our country's borders from air, land, and sea against any aggression.
Military officials say this drill sends a message of peace and security for regional states, while assuring their neighbors that the Islamic Republic's military doctrine is based on deterrence, not aggression. Iran's army says the drill drew a clear map of its strategies to manage UAV-based attacks and counterattacks in real-time war scenarios. Given the recent trade of threats between Iran and its enemies, the Iranian army says this maneuver sends a strong message that Iran's borders are safer with its drones. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drill.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has hailed the nation's resistance against U.S. sanctions and its economic war. Rouhani said Iran has emerged victorious despite hardships caused by the U.S. sanctions. He said Iran's economy grew in spring and summer despite restrictions caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Rouhani said the country is working on new development projects and inaugurates them on a weekly basis. The Iranian president called on the new U.S. administration to commit to its international obligations and abide by law. He said if the U.S. does so, Iran will fully meet its commitments too. The United States has imposed sanctions against Iran's steel industry and seized millions of dollars of Iranian assets abroad. The sanctions have targeted a dozen Iranian steel and metals makers and a Chinese company that makes elements for steel production. Among the blacklisted firms is Iran-based Middle East Mines and Mineral Industries Development Holding Company. The U.S. Treasury Department says it is also designating the company's subsidiaries and sales agents in Germany, China, and the U.K. The U.S. Justice Department has also busted $7 million in Iranian assets. The department says the money will be used to compensate victims of state terrorism. The restrictions are part of the outgoing U.S. president's administration's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Tehran has repeatedly condemned the sanctions, saying they amount to economic terrorism. Political commentator Jason Unruh says the new anti-Iran sanctions are part of a broader strategy by Washington to force Tehran to bow to its will and renegotiating the nuclear deal.
Well, the fact is the United States, particularly under U.S. President Donald Trump, has pursued a policy of perhaps trying to create a new JCPOA agreement. They completely just destroyed the existing one and started placing new pressure on Iran to try to get them to come to the negotiating table when there was already an agreement there. And I assume it's in order to change the terms. I suspect that perhaps the original agreement did not do the damage that they had hoped that it would. They had hoped to hold back Iran economically from the agreement, but it has not done the damage that they wanted. Strategy to punish the Islamic Republic for not bowing to U.S. will. And this seizure of assets is just going along more with the economic war that has been placed on the country, sanctions which have no actual international standing that have been forced on the country.
Democrats are on the path to victory in Senate runoff elections in the U.S. state of Georgia with approximately all the votes counted. U.S. media have projected Democrats Raphael Warnock is the winner of one of the two runoffs against Republican Senator Amy Loeffler. The other contest between Democrat John Ossoff and incumbent Republican David Perdue continues with a narrow lead for the Democratic candidate. The outcome of the Georgia elections will determine which party would gain control of the Senate. Republicans need the victory of either of their candidates to preserve their majority in the Senate. Democrats, however, must gain control over both seats to capture a majority in both houses of the U.S. Congress. Protesters have rallied in Washington, D.C. ahead of the affirmation of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the November presidential election. Demonstrators supporting President Donald Trump came out to show frustration at the outcome of the race for the White House. Police at some point fired tear gas to disperse the protesters. Similar rallies are planned by multiple pro-Trump groups for Wednesday. That's when Joe Biden's win is slated to be certified by Congress. President Trump has said he will address the rally of his supporters on Wednesday. Authorities in the U.S. Capitol have already boosted security. The city has mobilized the National Guard and issued a warning to protesters against carrying any sort of firearms. China has condemned a new U.S. ban on a series of Chinese applications accusing Washington of bullying.
I think this is another example of the U.S.'s bullying, hegemonic behavior in stretching the concept of national security, abusing national power, and unreasonably suppressing foreign companies.
The Chinese official said the U.S. ban would harm the interests of Washington and American consumers. She said China would take necessary measures to safeguard the legitimate rights of its targeted companies. On Tuesday, President Donald Trump signed an executive order banning transactions with 8 Chinese software applications. The move is the latest in curbs by the Trump administration on Chinese companies. Washington accuses them of posing a threat to its national security. Beijing says Hong Kong's move to arrest dozens of people over an unofficial opposition vote was necessary to stop external forces trying to undermine China's sovereignty. We discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen to what our guests had to say. China has defended Hong Kong's move to arrest dozens of people over an unofficial opposition vote.
The normal rights and freedoms enjoyed by the Hong Kong people have not been affected. What may be affected is only the kind of freedom of some external forces and individuals in Hong Kong to collude with each other to attempt to undermine China's stability and security.
The Chinese official was speaking hours after Hong Kong. Police said they'd arrested 53 people. The city's Security Secretary said the arrests were part of an operation targeting people suspected of overthrowing the government. Those arrested were tied to an unofficial vote in July 2020 to select opposition candidates for a postponed legislative election. The arrests were made under a national security law China passed in June. Hong Kong opposition says the law would curtail freedoms there. Beijing says it would boost security in the city. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Stephen Rabay, who's joining us from Beijing. Also, we have political analyst Angelo Giuliano, who's joining us from Montreux. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Stephen in Beijing. Stephen, what more can you share with us with regards to these arrests, and what message was being sent?
Well, from the activist point of view, what they did was legitimate and legal. They took advantage of a loophole in the system, gained the system, you might say, in an attempt to vote down the budget of the chief executive, Carrie Lam, and force her to resign. But from China's point of view, what they did was a clear aim to paralyze and bring down the Hong Kong government. That meets the description of subversion as outlawed by the new national security law. As the Chinese said, they wanted to stop external forces, individuals colluding to undermine China. So these arrests were perfectly legitimate as an attempt to maintain the stability of China and stop foreign-backed subversion. I mean, it has to be said that from about a few months after these protests started in May 2018, there was actually an element of trying to wreck Hong Kong. The demonstrators' stance, you could say, was that if they weren't going to get their way, they're just going to sink the whole ship. That was their stance. I mean, there was nothing illegal about that. Or, okay, well, you could say, well, rioting was illegal. But their efforts to paralyze Hong Kong, bring down the government, that wasn't. But from China's point of view, that's out and out. That's treason, as defined by this new national security law.
Thank you, Stephen. Let's get a word in from our guest in Montreux, Mr. Giuliano. Talk to us about these arrests, and also when we're focusing on the dynamics between China and Hong Kong. You heard what our correspondent in Beijing just said earlier. Has China become a little bit paranoid with regards to the United States and issues regarding Hong Kong?
What is happening now is, I think, is very legitimate. I don't see Beijing taking such actions if there was no strong evidence of breaching the national security law. So I think it's very important to understand the whole process, why we came to this point. You know, what happened in the last 18 months, there was a collusion with the foreign powers. And our colleague just mentioned before, Mr. Clancy, the lawyer, American lawyer, he was actually in charge of financing those protests, and this is a breach of the national security law. So it's very important to understand that what they were trying to achieve is a 35-plus majority in the Legislative Council, and they had a clear plan to veto Hong Kong budgets, which would lead to the resignation of the chief executive and put the city in the political chaos. So it is a clear sign of a subversion that would go against the national security law. So I think it is also a clear sign of immaturity of a generation that had got used to a legal loophole in the Hong Kong law. So the national security law, according to the basic law, Article 23, should have been implemented a long time ago. So for 22 years, since 1997, there is a generation of people that were bashing on China, that were brainwashed by media, U.S.-controlled medias, and financed by NED, National Endowment for Democracy, which is an extent of the CIA. So now there's a time now for Beijing to put everything back on track, to save Hong Kong, both from especially from foreign interference.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Let's leave it there. That was political analyst Angelo Giuliano joining us from Montreal. So thanks to our correspondent Stephen Revay, who's speaking to us from Beijing. And that's it with this edition of the News Review. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی است.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani is a champion of the Iranian nation and of the Islamic Ummah. This is the part of a speech delivered on December 16, 2020, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials of Shahid Soleimani commemoration anniversary and with the family members of that great martyr.
The three branches of government should work and cooperate together, in particular the heads of the three branches. If such solidarity, unity and cooperation are realized, national unity will certainly be strengthened on a daily basis. Well, one can negotiate. There are or might be certain differences. You should resolve them through negotiations. You speak about negotiating with the world. Very well. How is one able to negotiate with the world? But not able to negotiate with domestic forces. You should negotiate with one another and resolve the problems. Some of the comments that we hear these days are a source of sowing discord, not unity. The fourth and the last point, I have said this before as well, but I wish to repeat it again. Lifting the sanctions is in the hands of the enemy. But counteracting them is in our hands. Is this not the case? We cannot lift the sanctions on our own. It is the enemy who should do so. However, we ourselves are capable of counteracting the effects of his sanctions. Therefore, this takes priority and is the right course of action. We should follow the latter move.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, I am not saying that we should not be after lifting the sanctions. If we are able to lift the sanctions, we should not delay it, even for an hour. Of course, there is a four-year delay. Since year 1395 of the solar calendar, they have been intending to lift them all at once. But until today, not only have they not lifted, but they have also increased these sanctions. However, if we can lift them in a correct, reasonable, dignified, Islamic and Iranian way, we should do so. Nonetheless, you should not think too much about this. You should rather think about counteracting sanctions, which is an issue in your hands, as you are capable of doing it. And you should follow the matter and cooperate with one another in a diligent manner. This is my advice to you. I will support the officials of the country, but provided that they are committed to the nation's goals. I hope that Allah the Exalted will bestow on all the officials of the country the blessing to be able to accomplish great feats. God willing, greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
Hi everyone, this is Don. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss India-Pakistan border clashes.
Kashmir is one of the hottest flashpoints of the world. And with every clash or confrontation, it is getting dangerously closer to igniting a full-fledged nuclear war. The Muslim-majority Himalayan region is held by India and Pakistan in parts, but claimed by both countries in full, except for a small sliver that is controlled by China. There are Indian-administered and Pakistani-administered Kashmirs, but none of the two governments, nor the residents, can live with the status quo.
The latest bout of border battles between Pakistan and India took place in mid-November. Artillery and machine gun clashes were reported all along the 740-kilometer ceasefire line that has separated the nuclear-armed rivals for the past 70 years, the so-called Line of Control, LOC. Pakistan and India, as usual, accuse each other for initiating the fight that killed about 15 people and wounded many more on both sides. Kashmiri villagers describe the skirmishes as the worst and most widespread they had witnessed in months. Denouncing the attack as unprovoked and indiscriminate, the Pakistani military and government said Indian rockets and mortar shells in various sectors along the line of control killed 4 Pakistani civilians and 1 soldier and wounded 27, including women and children.
It's a serious escalation. We have given them a very befitting reply. There have been massive losses on Indian side in men and material.
In Srinagar, the capital of Indian-controlled Kashmir, the Indian military told a different story, saying they foiled an infiltration attempt following suspicious movement in multiple sectors along the line of control. The army said 6 civilians, 3 soldiers and a border guard were killed, while several other people were wounded on their side.
India's allegations of intrusion are vehemently rejected by Pakistan, who says that these attacks are a part of New Delhi's consistent attempts to escalate the situation along the line of control. Pakistan believes that it is India that keeps violating international agreements, saying that India had committed more than 2,700 ceasefire violations since the beginning of the year 2020, killing 25 people and causing serious injuries to more than 200 civilians.
The latest incident happened a day after Pakistan summoned an Indian diplomat to protest what it called India's violation of a 2003 ceasefire agreement. 2 civilians were wounded on the Pakistani side of the border in that exchange.
If
Sardar Masood Khan, the leader of the Pakistani-administered Kashmir, has urged the United Nations and the international community to help solve the issue, warning of a wider conflict. He said that if such hostilities are not stopped, it will be difficult to stop a war between Pakistan and India. The UN says it investigates alleged ceasefire violations complaints in a timely fashion within the constraints of a difficult operating terrain, practically stalling any move toward any resolution. Reiterating that the situation at the line of control remains tense and unpredictable, a UN peacekeeping spokesperson told Newsweek that the mandate by the UN military observer group in India and Pakistan has lapsed since the signing of the Simla Agreement of 1972. About a year after the Bangladesh Liberation War that transformed into the Indo-Pakistani War of 1971, then Prime Minister Indira Gandhi and President Zulfikar Ali Bhutto signed a treaty to put an end to the conflict and confrontation and settle their differences by peaceful means through bilateral negotiations.
Now, for more analysis, we are joined by Mr. Anil Chugunayath. He's a former Indian senior diplomat and an ambassador, and Mr. Abdullah Khan, the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Gentlemen, welcome to the subcontinent. So, let's start in India. Mr. Chugunayath, from time to time we see clashes between India and Pakistan on the Kashmir border. Why is that? And what's needed to stop the conflict?
Well, it's a historic question. As you know that when India achieved its independence from the British in 1947, the country was divided between the two. And we used to have more than 590 states, princely states. So they were given the option to join India or Pakistan. Now the Kashmiri king who was there, Hari Singh, he decided to join India. And then the Pakistanis sent their forces at the time when both the countries were trying to grapple with the thing. And they sent the Mujahids and all that to fight and occupy the large tract of the territory. And since then the people intervened, and this has remained a problem. Now, as you know, that if you go by the 26th October 1948 agreement, it is very clear that the Kashmir has become a part of India because they legally acceded to India, whereafter the Indian forces helped them detract the Pakistani Mujahids and Mujahideens and all those people who had come to fight and tribals and all. Since then, India and Pakistan have fought several wars. Now, at one time, it was referred to the United Nations in the beginning, and then it was decided in 1972 with the Simla Accord that both the countries will decide all their issues, including Kashmir, through bilateral negotiations. Now, Pakistan off and on continues to talk, and then what happened is that Pakistan, in order to achieve its objectives, it has started using terrorism as a state policy, and that has created the biggest problem and a hiatus in the relationship. We have had wars in 1965, we have had wars 71 again in 1999. So since Kashmir is part of India, we had recently abrogated the Article 370 so that the Kashmiris can get the benefit of India's democratic development and the development generally, and applicability of all the laws that apply within the Indian state. But what Pakistan has done on the contrary, in 1963, they ceded a part of the territory that they had occupied to China. Imagine now, apart from the fact that they themselves were illegally occupying it, they had also sent it to, given it to China. And now recently, Gilgit Baltistan, they have tried to make a part of their state of their country. Now, that is again illegal. So I believe that only option for us is to work together, and Pakistan has to contain the terrorism, because today it is not Kashmir which is the real issue. The real issue actually is Pakistan's use of terrorism against India.
All right, Mr. Chugunayath. So Mr. Khan, our guest in New Delhi says that Kashmir is not the issue. What do you think is the issue and how can it be solved?
First of all, by claiming that Kashmir is not an issue and that terrorism or anything else is an issue, it is an attempt to actually hide sun behind your finger. We all know that the main reason, the root cause of unrest in Kashmir is the Kashmir issue, their right of self-determination. And that is the key. And unless that issue is resolved, the issue of violence in Kashmir, we call it freedom struggle, the Indians call it terrorism or whatever they can say, Atangwad or whatever they use the terminology, the basic root cause is actually the right of the people of Kashmir, the right of self-determination. And I would like to tell you that what the Indian claim that instrument of accession, which they can never and they had never and they can never produce in the front of the international community, the original instrument of accession, because they actually forced the Maharaja, because when he was under pressure by the unrest going on in Gilgit-Baltistan and parts of Kashmir, so India actually had entered its forces well before the so-called instrument of accession. But before that instrument of accession, the Maharaja had signed a standstill agreement with Pakistan. The state of Jammu and Kashmir had become part of Pakistan since partition in 1947. And then it was India which took it to the UN Security Council. And it was India's repeated pledges that India will allow people of Jammu and Kashmir to exercise their right of self-determination. Now, all of a sudden saying that this is not an issue, the issue is terrorism, please address the root cause. What you asked, why the clashes are going on, I would like to say that since India last year forcefully, illegally annexed Kashmir and made it part of the Indian territory, now they are trying to actually occupy Azad Kashmir, which is the part which is administered by Pakistan. So they are now actually trying to do some nefarious design against Pakistan in Azad Kashmir and Gilgit-Baltistan, and that is the reason Pakistan is trying to expel them. And we should actually look at what the UN says. As per the international law, all the bilateral agreements are superseded by the international commitments of countries. So India and Pakistan both have committed that the Kashmir will be resolved as per the UN Security Council resolutions. So our Indian friends are generally confusing international community with their stances which cannot be supported by legal argument. So the basic fact is, and what the resolution is, and as you asked, how this can be stopped, that can only be stopped when the Kashmir issue will be resolved as per the wishes of the people of Kashmir. And that is the key, actually.
Thank you, gentlemen. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this segment, and good discussion.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
Since they gained independence, New Delhi and Islamabad have fought four wars. In 1948, 1965, 1971, and 1991, three of these wars have been over Kashmir. Tensions soared in February 2019 when Pakistan shot down an Indian warplane in Kashmir and captured a pilot in response to an airstrike by Indian aircraft targeting militants inside Pakistan. India said that strikes targeted Pakistan-based militants responsible for a suicide bombing that killed 40 Indian troops in the Indian-controlled part of Kashmir. But the airstrike killing the militants is largely disputed by the international media and site inspectors.
India's cooperation with the United Nations Military Observer Group in India and Pakistan was further urged in a letter sent by Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi to the UN Security Council. The Pakistani top diplomat's letter came ahead of Prime Minister Imran Khan's virtual address to the UN General Assembly. For a second year in a row, the Pakistani leader spoke at length about alleged abuses on the Indian-administered side of Kashmir and warned of potential war, calling on the UN Security Council to step in to prevent a disastrous conflict by implementing resolutions.
Mr. President, there will be no durable peace and stability in South Asia until the Jammu and Kashmir dispute is resolved on the basis of international legitimacy. Kashmir has been rightly described as a nuclear flashpoint.
Indian diplomat Mijito Vinito, the first in New Delhi's UN mission, who walked out of the room during Khan's speech, later insisted on his country's right to the region and asked Pakistan to leave Kashmir.
The Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir is an integral and inalienable part of India. The only dispute left in Kashmir relates to that part of Kashmir that is still under illegal occupation of Pakistan. We call upon Pakistan to vacate all those areas that it is in illegal occupation of.
In his own speech that same day, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi did not bring up the issue of Kashmir.
While leaving the subcontinent, the British enabled a division of the country on religious grounds, with the Muslim-dominated regions becoming a part of Pakistan and others staying a part of India. As per the partition formula, Kashmir could have gone to Pakistan as was expected by the Pakistani leadership. But the Hindu king was not ready to make an immediate decision and signed a standstill agreement with Pakistan to keep the flow of trade, communication and travel. The whole bloody affair may have been started by the UK, but the US role in fueling the flames of conflict seem undeniable.
The recent skirmishes in Kashmir serve as a momentous warning to the entire world, as a similar rivalry is simmering between India and China in another part of the Himalayas, on the backdrop of a global coronavirus pandemic and a messy post-election United States. As the world's most likely venue for a nuclear war, Kashmir is a contentious issue for Washington's foreign policy, since the US is deeply involved with both countries and stuck between them. The US needs its long-term partner India to play a supporting role in blunting China's increasing rise. At the same time, Washington heavily relies on Pakistan as an essential player in the negotiations with Taliban to conclude decades of America's war in Afghanistan. The US donates billions of dollars to both countries annually and has tried a wide array of strategies, but everything turns out to be ultimately in vain. It cannot make India reconsider its often heavy-handed management of Jammu and Kashmir that inspires more militancy. And it also cannot make Pakistan change its policy of negligence about the supposedly banned groups that operate against New Delhi. Given the prospects and perils of the escalating fight for Kashmir, the global community does not afford to feign ignorance and remain indifferent, as the planet may be approaching to the precipice of a disaster.
All right, so in the previous segment, we heard from our guests in India and Pakistan. Now let's bring in a Kashmiri voice and talk to Mr. Rafiq Katwari. He's a Kashmiri activist and commentator. Mr. Katwari, welcome to the show. Time and time again, we hear about these clashes between India and Pakistan. What do you think is the source of these conflicts?
Time and again, the present regime in New Delhi has been propagating to its diehard Hindutva followers that Pakistan is the source of all that ails India, that Pakistan is the enemy. This is a deflection, and it plays well on the 24/7 news channels, where the anchors are the definition of jingoism. And most of these 24/7 news channels are owned by arms merchants who are actually agents of the global arms industry, and India is a big market these days, or at least used to be a couple of years ago, for the arms market. Now, during the last 6 or 7 years that the BJP regime, the Bharatiya Janata Party regime, has been in power, India's economy has declined drastically. These clashes are really, at the moment, a deflection by Mr. Modi, because India's economy is in dire straits.
Mr. Katwari, you earlier said that the reason why all of this is happening is because the Indian economy is in dire straits. So what is the ultimate solution for Kashmir?
And the ultimate solution, the most democratic solution, is self-determination. Okay, respecting the wishes of the people. Now, if the powers that be wanted that to happen, it could happen within 48 hours. If there is a will, there is a way. India and Pakistan are nuclear nations. The road to peace in South Asia, in fact, the road to a just solution of the Kashmir dispute and a just peace in Afghanistan is through Kashmir. Either you build a bridge holding hands with the Kashmiri people, or you build a bridge over the Kashmiri people. But for God's sake, build something. Don't destroy the societies. Don't destroy people. Don't destroy their hopes, just as India has done over the past over 1 year when it abolished Kashmir's limited autonomy. And people live by symbols. We had our own flag. That was taken away from us. We were reduced from a state of the Indian Union to a union territory. And now what has set in over the last 1 year in a very hurried way is what you would call the Israeli model. What Israel has been doing in Palestine, India is now in a very accelerated way doing in Kashmir. Apple trees are being chopped away just as olive trees have been chopped away. Children are being arrested. People are being put in jails for no apparent reason, especially given the COVID situation. Laws are being changed. Demographics are being changed. So we are back to what happened to, or what has happened, what has happened to Palestine is now, of course, being copied by India. But again, I just want to assure your viewers, and I want to assure myself, that, you know, Modi's come and Modi's go, and inshallah, we will one day learn to how to deal with all this situation. Because, we will get what is due to us and India will get its karma.
All right. The ultimate solution is self-determination. Thank you so much, Mr. Katwari, for being with us and sharing your opinions. It was nice having you with us. Let's see how people on social media see this situation.
By posting painting drawn by a Kashmiri student, Adhar Parvaiz tries to portray the sorrow of the people of Kashmir. Jai Kamath believes that removal of the Article 370 by BJP was just a tool to further oppress the Kashmiris, while most parts of India don't care about them. In this tweet, Safina Nabi shares her observations of the situation of South Kashmir and criticizes the government for its actions in the region. This one is a short video which has recently gone viral, showing how the military forces treat a journalist from India today. Referring to the previous post, Tusif Wani expressed concern about the situation of local journalists and how the military forces treat them. And Tony Ashoi also opines that the resistance of the people against oppression will eventually lead to the negotiation of the oppressors with the oppressed.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our episode covering the Indian-Pakistan border clashes along the line of control in Kashmir. We'll meet next week.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are.
Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, He is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-Aliyy al-Azim. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره. Last night we talked about a very important dimension of balance that must exist in every person and in our community, and that is the balance that we should strike between being emotional and being rational. We need to have both, and if we lose one of them or if we overdo one of them, then it creates problems. I mentioned two hadith about the significance of having a kind of emotional unity or connection or link with Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And now I'm going to share with you the third hadith, which leads us to another characteristic of the community, and that is truthfulness. Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam, in a famous hadith, said, إن الله تبارك وتعالى أطلع إلى الأرض فاختارنا واختار لنا شيعة. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala looked at the earth, looked at the people, and among them He chose us. And He chose for us some Shia, some followers. ينصروننا. These are the people that help us. These are the people that work for achieving our goals. Then Amirul Mu'mineen said, "Man adha'a sirrana, adhaqahu Allahu ba'sa al-hadid." If someone discloses our secrets, Allah will make him taste the pain of iron. It means that he is going to see the attacks of the enemies, the swords and bombs and killings coming from enemies, prison, torture, because he was not careful about keeping the secrets. Okay, now because Amirul Mu'mineen mentioned the point about truthfulness, I move to the other characteristic of the community of Ahlul Bayt, which I promised in the first night that inshallah we are going to expand on that. The community of Ahlul Bayt has to be truthful. Another hadith is from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. لا تغتروا بصلاتهم ولا بصيامهم. You see, there are people who pray, who fast, but don't be deceived. Of course, those who don't pray and don't fast, you know that they are not good people. But those who pray and fast, this doesn't mean that they are from every aspect okay. Why? فَإِنَّ الرَّجُلْ لُبَمَا لَهِجَ بِالصَّلَاةِ وَالصَّوْمِ حَتَّى لَوْ تَرَكَهُ اسْتَوْحَشَ. Sometimes a person has so much said prayer and fasted that it has become a habit. No matter whether he is good or bad, whether he is pious or not, this is the way he has been brought up with. If he doesn't do this, he feels bad. اسْتَوْحَشَ, he feels bad. So question, O Imam, so how can I find whether someone is good or not? How can I find this person is a good Shia or not? I was thinking by looking at prayer and fasting I can understand. Imam says no, this is not enough. وَلَكِنْ اِخْتَبِرُوهُمْ عند صدق الحديث وأداء الأمانة. Test them. Are they truthful and are they trustworthy or not? If someone is truthful, is honest, and is trustworthy, he's a good person. Because, you know, it's very difficult to be selfish and be honest. Because those who are selfish, always they want to do something to bring everything towards themselves. All the good things they want to bring. So they cannot remain honest. They have to cheat. They have to tell lies. If you see someone is all the time truthful and trustworthy, then you can be sure that this person has great commitment in his heart to Haqq, to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Another hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. لا تنظروا إلى طول ركوع الرجل وسجوده. In the previous hadith, Imam said, don't look at fasting and prayer. Here, Imam says, even don't look at the quality of his prayer. Maybe he's the one that he does very nice salat. His ruku takes 3 minutes. Sajda, 5 minutes. Every sajda, 5 minutes. After sajda, half an hour, dua, ta'qibat. Imam says, this is not enough. لا تنظروا إلى طول ركوع الرجل والسجود فإن ذلك شيء اعتاده. This has become his habit. He's used to this. فلو تركه استوحش لذلك. If he doesn't do this one day, he feels bad. Someone is ill, we have to take him to hospital. He says, no, I have to do my salat. And he, you know, delays you so that you go yourself. Say, okay, I take a taxi, I go. I don't need you to help me. If you are a mu'min, today you have to make your salat faster because we need to take someone to hospital. No, he has become, you know, used to this. He cannot change. فَلَوْ تَرَكَهُ اسْتَوْحَشَ لِذَلِكَ وَلَكِنْ انْظُرُوا إِلَى صِدْقَ حَدِيثِهِ وَأَدَاءِ أَمَانَتِهِ. But look at his truthfulness in his speech and in his trustworthiness.